This is the Erasing Shame Podcast, Season 5, Diverse Perspectives Discussing What Matters. Episode number 3, Being Asian in America, but Not Belonging. Welcome to this episode of the Erasing Shame Podcast, where we have diverse perspectives discussing what matters. I'm DJ Chuang, joined with my co-hosts, Hannah Lee, George Chung, and Leah Abraham. Welcome back, everybody. How's everybody doing?
Hey. Doing all right.
We had a lot of... Yes,
Leah. Oh, I was saying, I just heard the phrase COVID okay recently when asking how someone is. I feel like COVID okay.
That sounds all right. Well, we've had a lot of things happen, and we're going to talk about two of them on this episode. One is the impeachment trial, and then the second one is Stop Asian Hate. So first, we're going to start with the impeachment trial and how quick it went in the Senate and how disillusioning and disappointing the outcome was. George, what did you think as you heard the news, or did you watch the trial?
Yeah, I... You know, being able to work from home, it's nice. My wife and I watched the trial while we were working. And man, it was short, but it was exhausting at the same time. And I think it was just really emotionally draining to experience that impeachment in particular. And especially with the way everything turned out and the ways in which... they wrapped it up with their final statements after the vote. And it was really interesting, one, to watch it knowing that he probably was going to get acquitted, right? But at the same time, hopeful that people would be, that our representatives would be more holistic in their thinking and aware of what they were setting up. And it was just really difficult to watch, knowing that our hopes probably were going to get squashed. I'm wondering, as you guys were watching or as you guys were processing through it, were there any strong emotions that came out, any frustrations that you felt like, you know, you had to quell at times? What did that look for you guys?
Yeah, that was a hard one for me, because I think for a minute I had hope, like for just a second. I was like, maybe they will do what's right, especially after the riots in the Capitol. And I thought we were so well positioned. And then as it sort of unfurled, of this realization is like, oh, the system still doesn't change, right? The system continues to work in favor of so many people. And for me personally, I had to grapple with when things like this happen and when I'm reminded over and over again that the system benefits this group of people, I always, for me, it like brings up a lot of hurt in terms of, do I even belong in this country? Is there even space for me, right? And so it was just another reminder, like the white supremacy still reigns, and what does it mean for me to move through? Yeah, how do I move through the world? How do I move through this country? Knowing that even after all of that, he still got acquitted. So I'm grappling with questions of that and of, it sucked. It really sucked. I really needed to remind myself to breathe.
Well, without getting into the political process about how many votes and then what would happen if the trial went through and so on, The nagging question I had was when McConnell gave his closing statement, he said there is no doubt that Trump was absolutely responsible for the insurrection and riot, and yet he voted to acquit. So what in the world does that mean? I mean, acquit is the very method by which you can weigh in your vote on Trump's culpability and guilt on causing the riot. And I'm not very, like, I get lost in the plural language, so I don't know whether to call that duplicity or hypocrisy or just total confusion. But that one really got to me and still nagging to me. I don't know if you can explain it to me or just, oh, this is all political play anyways.
I don't have any strong opinions on it because I think I checked out after the riots. I've been dealing with like a low grade depression since then and just grieving. So I didn't have much capacity besides listening on NPR to some of the trial. I think I resonate with the whole, like, I allowed myself to hope a little bit, but I expected, you know, politicians to do what they do. I think one thing that I've learned over time is that a lot of leaders won't do the right thing if it jeopardizes their career platform and what they're already doing. Because I can imagine that they feel beholden to their supporters and their constituents. And so even if they personally feel a certain way and logic points to something, they're very much tied to, well, am I going to end my career and throw away my reputation and all I worked so hard for over this one thing? You know, and a lot of people were like, no, I'm not going to throw it all away. There's so much other good I'm doing for my constituents and, you know, going to keep my eyes on the bigger picture and just let this one slide by. Yeah. And that's just kind of a reality, I think, is they got to where they are by making these kind of moral compromises. I feel like that's one of the realities of being a political leader. And that's disheartening. But I mean, they say that the Republicans are trying to form a third party. That was hopeful. We need something to shake the basic system.
Yeah, I think, you know, Leah, in listening to your response, politics brings up a lot of, you know, personal and internal shame, I think, where, right, we feel kind of the shame of, do we belong, right? There's this space in which we're almost kind of alienated in the space when we don't recognize the choices being made, the faces that are tied to those voices, right? And in that, we kind of feel the shame of, oh man, like I don't think I really matter, right? Am I really cared for and represented well? And I remember as soon as they started voting, turning to my wife and being like, I can't wait until 2040. And she's like, what's in 2040? I'm like, that's when hopefully the minorities become the majority and hopefully there's more representation in our government and in our systems. And, you know, I think the other side of that coin, right, is then this other conversation we're having around right and wrong, right? And then the shame that gets kind of thrown around in that space of, you made the wrong choice, you did the wrong thing, right? And how do we then process through the shaming of others for not being where we are or not having the same idea that we have and belief that we have? When you guys experience politics in your life, How does shame play out in your circles, in your families? What does that look like?
That's such a great question. I think just really quick, George, the whole shame around right and wrong and, you know, who has the upper hand or higher ground, I think that's a huge thing, is naming it and being like self-aware. Because, you know, like, I'm a therapist, but I still very much struggle with mental health and relationships and all the things my clients do, you know. And in my own family of origin, I've had to really check myself to be like, am I trying to like shame my mom right now for, you know, thinking mm-hmm. differently than me? And am I reacting to things that she says because I feel that she's trying to shame me or, you know, make me feel wrong and smaller and less than? And is there a way to share our positions and perspectives without shaming one another and trying to explore that space? For the most part, I think we've been trying to just use good boundaries and focus on connection of being like, well, this is my value. And that's why I support this politician or this political, you know, platform. But that's hard. It's so hard because you have to name things to yourself first. Mm-hmm. And then if you're able to with the other person in that space, you know, and thinking about emotional safety. I think people don't really think about politics and emotional safety in like the same space, but mm-hmm. it's really, really important. Yeah.
Yeah. There's almost that a mentality of if you're going to step into politics, you have to have a thick skin, right?
Oh, yeah.
You just have to expect that people are going to come at you yeah. and they, you know, oftentimes have no filters and have no, no breaks when it comes to coming at your beliefs and who you are as a person. So
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that's, yeah, it's really hard to feel safe in with that yeah. kind of mentality.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also interesting for me when I'm, talking about this with my parents, because I'm still trying to understand and learn their immigrant experience of politics. And both my parents and my family in general, they're not necessarily politically super involved, especially when they were in India, but I know what they had seen and what was happening in the time and the social and cultural background and structure really affects the way they see politics in the States right now. And while I think in India, the politics is more corrupt and there is a sense of like, the system's never for us. It's always for the greedy or the one with the bigger pocket, I think with my parents. And so it's always been a conversation of, how can I make you care? Like, how do we enter into the space I'm trying to like figure out how to tune down the apathy without shaming them, right? But by how do I invoke your curiosity and how do I, but I'm curious, like for, with immigrant families, like how do we take into account their experiences from their home countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, in my context with my immediate family, I'm married 25 years, have a 24-year-old son. My in-laws often keep Fox News running, mm-hmm. and my side of the family, in terms of my mom and brothers, they're pretty apathetic. And so the way shame shows up or not is that we don't talk about it. So shame festers in silence and it's just a off topic kind of thing. And for the insurrection and riot that we're speaking of, it seems to me that my in-laws would put a blinder on to that incident, which is also the way we handle shame, that there's a parallel, that if there's something mm-hmm. ugly and bad that happens, you just don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You ignore it. And what happens is when you don't talk about some things that need to be talked about, then it's suppressed, it festers, and it comes out sideways in other harmful ways to yourself and to others. I'm not sure what that's going to look like in terms of the long-term effect on them, but they're so into the supposed moral righteousness of Republicans in terms of its social values. That's the very narrow blinder that they look at in terms of politics. So it's not even really politics in one sense, because the social conservative values is just a module or a part of the whole power play, because politics is the power play, at least as far as I understand it. So that's how shame shows up, and politics is tossed into that shame category.
And it intersects with religion, right? For so many of us too. Yeah, and colonial roots even, like the intersection about colonial roots affects the religion, and colonial roots affects the politics and social landscapes. And so, yeah, it's a very messy, it can get very messy and complicated fast.
Which also points to the holistic nature of who we are. So we're talking right now in the month of February, which is Black History Month, and PBS has this really valuable and rich series about the Black church. And they describe really well, it's the best I've ever heard, and I'm 54 already, so it's the best I've heard of explaining the social dynamic, political dynamic, and the spiritual dynamic, and how all of that came together to give the Black people hope spiritually and politically and human-wise. And the energy and the resilience that Black people have amidst the generations of trauma is quite remarkable. And I don't know what that would look like in an Asian or Asian American context, but that was a very powerful, the Black church itself, I've come to appreciate just how powerful a thing it is.
Can you link that in our episode guide? That'd be great.
Yes, and that'll be in the show notes.
You know, I think as I was processing through even our last session, I thought to myself, man, what does this look like for not just me, but other Hmong people or Southeast Asian refugee type groups like myself? And part of me is torn, because I recognize that from a Southeast Asian perspective, that communism is something that many Southeast Asian refugees and immigrants want to flee from so much. And the rhetoric of democratic, the Democratic Party being so close to communism, and their values being tied to communism, cause this pendulum swing, or this very, you know, volatile reflex to stay away from it as much as possible. And so I see so many people from my context and my communities, like, feeling so strongly towards the Republican Party in that aspect. But beyond that, there's not a whole lot of sustenance to their political views or their understandings of why they vote the way that they vote or support the people that they support. And so for me, it creates a lot of confusion as to how do I respond in love to them, knowing that their trauma and their background is so much so against these things that they fear. And at the same time, process through my own frustration of, why are you saying this? Why are you posting this right now? Do you really recognize what you're saying in this? And trying to hold my tongue so that I'm not shaming them in that space. But man, it is definitely difficult to process through those things.
Yeah. Just a kind of funny anecdote. When I was an undergrad, I was majoring in Asian American studies, and I was trying to share some of the things that I was learning, you know, with my family. And my grandmother was present for one of those conversations where I was like, Mom, Dad, how do you say social justice in Korean? And they were like, and you know, we kind of worked around and tried to find a phrase. And my grandma goes, are you learning from the red commies or something in Korean? Like, bagging it there is the word, like almost like the you know, like the red coats kind of, you know, vibe. And I was like, what? Like, no. So then, you know, I was kind of realizing, wow, this is really different, the way we're looking at right and wrong, up and, you know, what's up and down. Just our worldviews are so different. But then, like, within the same quarter, and I was at UCLA at the time, there was also like a socialist newspaper that was student run on campus. And I like liked a lot of the content. And I was like, oh my God, my grandma was right. You know? And I was processing through a lot of that, because I think early, I don't know if it was just the UC students who were studying Asian American studies decades ago, they actually were taking trips to China to learn from political leaders there, right? Wow. So I was like, my grandma wasn't totally wrong, but her life experience is that maybe some of the like shiny promises of communism or socialism about what they understood as justice at the time were betrayed, right? And the leaders turned out to be very corrupt and doing things the wrong way. And so, yeah, I think sharing narrative and learning each other's experience and history about what happened is such a great way to find some kind of common ground of, oh, we actually all do value safety, you know, and the law being respected. But we also believe it's important to disagree and be able to speak, you know, to power and things like that. So, yeah. Funny story. My grandma called me out as a commie when I was 18.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this conversation is so interesting, because it almost feels as though, as quickly as the impeachment trial went, we all kind of feel now rushed into, let's just move away and move on. And I don't know if we'll ever have enough time to really process through what took on in that impeachment process, and you know, the outcome of it, and what that means for the Republican Party in the future, what that means for a lot of us who, you know, my wife was questioning, are wanting to be able to vote conservatively, but yet don't trust those who are currently in power, right? Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, and I don't know if we'll get a chance to really go through this process. But as you guys are coming out of it and seeing it, are there any kind of final thoughts on what it's going to look like moving forward? Is it kind of like Joe Biden saying, I don't want to talk about Trump anymore? Or is this a space where we feel like, man, we really got to keep working through this so that these things don't keep happening?
I made a joke to someone. I was like, we should take bets on if Trump is going to run again. Because I think that was the main reason I wanted to see him impeached, was like, just practically, you know, like, we need to make sure that man never has access to that kind of power again. But, you know, only time will tell. I'll take bets from you guys if you want to join the. We'll see. Praying against it for sure. But it's a reality that a lot of people still hope for that, because he represents something to them. A lot of people don't like him, but they like a lot of the things that he's willing to do for the little people, the small people, you know, the ones with no voice. And they view that he will stand for their social justice or their survival, you know, and that's, yeah, that's something to grapple with.
Wow, big questions. I have like, my brain is like processing so much now because George, like I was one of those people. I was like, okay, it's time to move on. I can't deal with this anymore. But I think there's a lot of wisdom. I think there, the news cycle moves so fast that I forget that slow news has a role, plays a very important role in how we process the information and how we make decisions on how we move through life. And so I think you, I think there's, you've given me a lot to think about of like, what is the lesson that I'm learning and what, how do I position myself? And yes, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of feels powerless because there's no one working on that issue anymore. Or it seems. Mm-hmm. The media is not putting it in the spotlight. And then so the energy has dissipated very quickly. Mm-hmm. And there's other urgent items that have surfaced, like the one we're just, we're on the brink of talking about. Mm-hmm. And it, if it surfaces, it'll be at the next presidential election as ammunition to wedge, like, you know, here's the consequences that were never dealt with and used as a political pawn to try to win the next presidential election because it looks like the House and the Senate are done with it. Unless there's some lawyers that are going to try to do some conviction on legal crimes or other means, but that's what it looks like from here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leah, when you're done, processing, you know, you being a, you know, a editor and everything and being a part of that kind of media world, I'd love to kind of hear those reflections. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think as commoners, right, we kind of just receive the news and digest it as quickly as we can and then continue on with our lives. But yeah, there's a lot that goes into how the media moves us along in our lives. And I wasn't even aware that I was asking that kind of question, but I'm glad that it came out that way. So,
thank you, George.
George, it's funny how you said commoner. I was thinking civilian because there's information wars right now. And, you know, who to trust. So, Leah, that makes you military. You're leading a battalion with your magazine.
It's just in the military.
We're civilians. Yeah.
Well, that's the marvelous land that we live in here in the United States of America. And in the age of social media, it has opened the opportunity for us commoners to have a voice and to start galvanizing and building other like-minded people around a cause and to raise our voices collectively and to lean into the Bill of Rights with our freedom to assemble and the freedom of speech to mobilize people to deal with systemic issues, you know, on up that rank. And the other immediate issue that has just surfaced is Asian American hate crimes. It continues to increase during this COVID crisis. And our elderly are being attacked viciously, slashed, pushed. It's just so ugly. And a hashtag has surfaced, Stop Asian Hate, that seems to galvanize all the other hashtags that have been ongoing. And I've noticed that the commoners are gathering their voices through Clubhouse. It's an iPhone app. And there was a 4-hour session that I listened in on last week, hosted by Daniel Day Kim and Lisa Ling. And at that grassroots level, they were looking to mobilize petitions on, or mobilizing signatures on petition at change.org, which I'll add in the show notes. It's approaching 25,000 people now to get mainstream media coverage about Asian hate crimes. And now it has reached that point where it is being covered by CNN and NBC News. And so it has reached that point. And then just this weekend, as we're talking on this episode, big brands like Apple and Nike are starting to weigh in and stand in solidarity with Asian hate crimes. So that's what we're in the midst of now. And there's a lot more work to do. So I'm going to hand the mic to Hannah. Clubhouse style. Hand the mic. So Hannah, would you weigh in and guide us through our discussion on this thing that matters so much for us as Asians and Asian Americans?
Yeah. I guess you know, I've been processing and really wanting to hear other people's process and kind of how things are sitting with you after hearing and learning about and we were practicing this name, hashtag Justice for Vicha, and the Thai American elder Vicha Ratanapakti, who you know, was assaulted and killed, and that's been sitting so heavy. And the immediate thing that comes to mind is, you know, justice for George Floyd, right? And what happened last year, and the series of events that really brought some kind of reckoning or started a process for a lot of people. I've been struggling and actually working through that shame issue because I love seeing the AAPI community rally around, and Amanda Nguyen, her video went viral and, you know, got the attention of a lot of media outlets. But struggling with, well, on one hand, like, it's not enough. Like, why don't people care more? This is horrific. We're in grief, you know, we're angry, we're hurting, we're sad. And at the same time, kind of struggling with this whole, like, but I'm so used to our community being so invisible and silent and not cared for, that asking for visibility brings up issues of shame, you know, and wondering, like, should we still, because a lot of the Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, you know, movements and justice movements have sort of died down in the media and elsewhere. It's not like sexy and cool and trendy anymore, you know? And so I've been feeling this burden on one hand of, we need to continue that work and talk about stopping police brutality and racism, but we're also part of the conversation, but how loud are we allowed to be, right? And personally for me, this comes out of, I was in a BIPOC training for mental health clinicians learning the trauma treatment. And I brought it up, you know, with my partner of, can Asians speak up when horrific things happen to us that are also racially motivated? Or should we stay quiet until, other communities who've had, you know, more oppression? And I say with quotes because, you can't really quantify or compare, right? But on the outside, it feels like, but you've had so many more of your people go through this than my people, right? So yeah, I would love to hear kind of how it's been sitting with you all and what effect it's had on you, what it's brought up in you, and how, yeah, how you're kind of processing all the late events.
Yeah, it's, definitely heavy on my heart. One, because I mean, my parents aren't elderly, right? But they're old and they're not necessarily capable of fending for themselves. And the thought of my dad working in downtown St. Paul like frightens me a bit. The fact that my mom, you know, works second shift and you know, is driving home and doesn't get home until midnight-ish. And she had already been mugged twice in our neighborhood. You know, those situations really draw it close to home and make it really difficult. And it's frustrating. And we hear the Asian American influencers, right, talking about how this is so heinous and horrible because individuals know that these elderly people won't fight back. They won't cause a scene. And so they're the easiest targets. And it's just so frustrating that that these things, these attacks keep happening, that these individuals feel so emboldened to go out and act out on their hate. And I think you bring up also a really good point in there's this conversation of race that happens in America, and it feels so much like a black and white binary. Mm-hmm. And so for Asian Americans, at least in my experience, we kind of are given this call to be a bridge in that space, but yet don't have a voice in that binary to discuss our concerns, our issues, our community. And that in itself kind of brings out a lot of that shame that you're talking about of, Do I raise my hand to to speak? Do I just shout out of frustration? And so that binary makes things difficult. And, you know, I think it's great that right now these stories are coming out and we're getting coverage. But, I mean, this was happening way back last year, February, you know, March and April. And it's just getting coverage now, right? And so part of that, again, is how media plays things out. But it also has taken this much time for the Asian American community to really gather its voice and make itself heard.
Oh, and just, George, to piggyback off of, you know, happening last year, there's the research project where they were tracking the number of reported crimes against API people, especially with COVID, when Trump was using inflammatory language and calling it the Wuhan virus or the China virus. So, yeah, you know, the numbers are daunting and heartbreaking. And we're still struggling to find a voice. I guess one thing I would love to hear your thoughts on is, and I had a family member who was assaulted with the whole, like, you know, go back to China, you brought the virus, and I'm Korean. So there's, you know, a little bit of like, not only did you misidentify me, but, you know, this is not okay against anybody. But my family member went straight to the police because that represented safety and justice. And in the BIPOC communities, you know, that I've been a part of, police brutality and not being able to trust law enforcement and those with authority, that's been an issue, you know? And so feeling kind of trapped where we're like, well, a lot of Asians still feel safe with the police. And when these things happen, they're the first ones we go to, right? That is not the case with the Black and Brown community. But when they're standing in solidarity with us, and there are so many that are standing in solidarity with the API community, how do we wrestle with that?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that. Because as DJ mentioned earlier, like, February is Black History Month in the States. And I think there was a lot of guilt in my part when I was thinking, like, should I be talking about this more on my social media when it's like, it was a very interesting thought that crept up. I think one thing that helps me is that one of my core values is the principle of, like, Ubuntu, like, I am because you are. And so when I talk about liberation or freedom, like my liberation has to be bound to the freedom of those around me. And so it always has to be both and, right? It can't be either or. And in sort of my personal journey, like, my personal journey of decolonization, when I first found that word and found that journey, a lot of that began with the process, like I had to process and grieve when I realized it's like, oh, what parts of my life were not touched by colonization as an Indian woman? And I was like, crap, I can maybe count it like on one hand. And that just sort of propelled me into this just deep grief and then into this sort of study into my origins and all of that. But it was a friend recently posted something that shifted my perspective a little bit, because I can't talk about decolonization when living in the United States without talking about land rights for Indigenous people, right? And like the core of that decolonization journey, when as long as I'm a guest on this land, is that land was stolen. And so my initial reaction, I was like, oh crap, like, but the British colonized India. There was just that this internal struggle for a second, and it took me a while to sort of think about it more. And I think in the context of us living in the United States, I'm here because of so many civil rights activists who fought for the abilities for so many minority communities to actually, like, the immigration laws to be opened up for. Anyway, it's just like as I trace all of these back, I think I'm still wrestling through a lot of it, but also it just solidifies that idea of our liberation is bound to each other's. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this one hits a bit closer to home in many ways, right? But yeah, so those are sort of the things that I've been sort of thinking about and wrestling with recently.
I'm wondering how many of our viewers and audience have heard the word decolonization, and if maybe it might be helpful for some people to get a little bit of a definition for it, because it was a new word for me in the past 10 years.
Oh, that's a good thing. How do you describe decolonization? I'm gonna Google it real quick.
Yeah.
Well, while Leah is Googling, the latest numbers from Stop AAPI Hate, they just released a press release on February 9th, and they've had over 2,800 anti-Asian hate crimes since March, when the quarantine started.
Wow.
And about 7% have been against elderly over 60. And these are just hate crimes that are reported.
Right.
You can easily anticipate it's at least double that because of our Asian cultures reticent to report bad things that happen to them, and the language barrier and all that. I'll add a link in the show note in the petition to get more media coverage, because that is one avenue of getting the word out in terms of education and awareness, in terms of influencing culture. It's up to 104,000 signatures digitally. Mm-hmm. So that's at change.org. I'll add a link in the show notes. But as Leah was sharing, I was recognizing how overwhelming it is to be an Asian American, knowing the effects and trauma that we bear and live under because of the systemic social injustices, and how our freedom and value is tied to other BIPOC and the Indigenous people. It can be so overwhelming that we freeze, and then it triggers our shame for not doing enough.
Yes.
Shame is that painful feeling of not being enough. And so I want to offer a word of release, that there is more needs that we can tackle. But if we're doing something, that's a good, healthy first step. We can't do everything. So get realistic on that. We can't do everything. We can't be perfect, but we can do something, and we can take care of ourselves. And with this opportunity, stop Asian hate crime, we can learn to take care of our community. This, mm-hmm. as ugly as an opportunity it is an opportunity for us to finally come together because it is coming close to home.
Yeah. Mm. DJ, I feel so like ministered to with you sharing that. I just really appreciate that. And I hope people out there feel encouraged to join hands. I think that's been one beautiful thing that's always I've seen come out of tragedy is that people come together when there's crisis. The issue is that it's often not sustained. But I would love to see more sustained coming together and solidarity building and learning each other's languages in some sense, like learning new words like decolonization and why that's important to people and working through some of those shame issues by naming it, you know. As a therapist, I really love that you pointed out that word freeze. DJ, you're like a therapist and a pastor. I love it.
Well, this podcast has been therapeutic for me, so
right.
You want to offer that to others as well.
But realizing that when we are in that freeze mode, it's often because we don't feel safe, but orienting ourselves to kind of what space we're in and then learning from others and following others' example, those are great next steps, you know. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Leah, did you finish Googling?
Yeah. I don't love the Wikipedia definition of it.
You can rewrite it, you know.
Oh, yeah, you get it.
It's the undoing of colonialism, mm-hmm. and other parts, like it's also dismantlement of colonial empires. But I think it's more complicated than that, and it looks different based on your ethnic background and the land you live in. So I think it's a lot of colonialist, just dismantling colonialist structure, narratives, and power in wherever you live and in your own makeup. So for example, like for me, like, while India is no longer under the British colonial rule, so much colonialism is still present for us in the way education systems are structured and the way we are taught to think, the way borders were drawn. And so decolonization for me looks like, how do I free myself from that thought and power structure that's sort of ingrained into me naturally? And in the United States, it looks a lot different. It looks like advocating for Black and Brown and Indigenous neighbors. And it looks, immigration itself has a lot of colonization, just colonial myths and stuff attached to it. Yeah. Am I missing any part of any core?
I'm appreciating that you have such an international view with Indian history. I feel like for the average Asian American, the word colonial, you think of like eighth grade US history, and that's the last time you use that word with people. Mm-hmm. And so realizing that power structure and dynamic is still relevant today. All the wrong things that were happening that you learned about when you were 13, you know, they still resonate and affect people's lives and oppress and naming it, right? And the phrases that get kind of tossed around are also like white supremacy, and that's equated with the whole colonial mentality or the idea. I think that's new for a lot of Asian Americans even. Mm-hmm. And definitely for our Asian immigrant parents and elders who did not sit in a U.S. history class when they were young, completely foreign, unless they're from somewhere like Hong Kong or Taiwan or India or other places that have experienced more recent colonization.
Mm.
It's interesting because once you start looking at it through that lens, that's all you sort of see. So for me, when I see the uptick of Asian hate crimes in this country, I see what was happening like 40, 50, 100 years ago happening again over here. Yeah. To me, it's that narrative that continues as if the lack of whiteness in your skin, in your culture, makes you are like embarking on our land, right? You are not welcome here. And so for me, doing the work to stop Asian hate is work of decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
Undoing the myth of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And learning your history. We don't get to learn Asian American history growing up in American school systems.
Mm-hmm.
I think recently there's been more of a move to that, but we learn white history. When you're in a US history class, you're learning white people history.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I got to college and majored in Asian American studies that I got to learn in depth a lot of stories. Oh. Mm. That completely shifted my worldview. But I didn't, growing up, I had no access to that. I was invisible. You know, people who looked like me had no voice and no story.
I just want to make two quick notes. One, super thankful for this conversation because it's doing a whole lot of mess inside of me. And I think, as I'm listening to you both kind of process through what you're thinking about decolonization and what that looks like in your life and what that looks like in your context, right? I just know that I personally struggle, and I think a lot of Hmong people struggle with this idea because we haven't been colonized. But there's also this issue of we don't have a nation, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have a place that we can really go back to feel like this is who we are as a people. All we really have are ourselves and our families and our communities. And so just hearing the word decolonization within a Hmong context, like that would be so foreign, like so odd to even think about. And I'm thinking, well, maybe there's more colonization that, you know, doesn't necessarily happen with, you know, white people, but it happens in the other Asian countries that we are living in. And even in that space, like my knowledge of the Hmong people is, no, we were never colonized. We always had our own kingdoms. We always had our own places. We were just oppressed and genocided often. And had to flee from our locations. And so even in that space, it's like, okay, we've got this survivor mentality and this fear of assimilation so much so that we deny any outside influence. And that's, you know, of course, dying out as we get into our third and fourth gen experiences here in America. But man, the first, second gen, and the 1.5ers were like, what is this? Like, we don't have a whiteness that we've allowed into, or we've been so fearful of allowing, you know, colonialism into our context. So there's just a whole lot of processing I'm doing through that. And the other note that I wanted to just quickly make was, as we're talking about the shame that's brought up in Asian American voices trying to be raised, I think oftentimes what we find ourselves fighting against is stepping into the oppression Olympics, right? And it's this space in which we're like, no, listen to my oppression, listen to what I've been through, listen to what my people have been through. You know, I remember going to a march here in Chicago, and at the end of the march, I really had to use the bathroom. So I asked a random stranger, if I could walk, if I could use his bathroom. And his family was out on the steps, and you know, we were conversing with them for a little bit, and we were trying to explain yellow peril to these individuals who we were just marching for, right? And they were like, okay, but who are the people who are really oppressed, right?
Yeah.
And it's that kind of response that I think Asian Americans often get is, okay, but who really had it bad?
Yeah.
That shames us and makes us recoil.
Yeah.
And makes us feel like, okay, maybe we don't have a voice here. Right. And I think, Leah, the way that you're processing through even like decolonization, right? And that beautiful concept of Ubuntu, did I say that right? Right, is if we can just accept that we all have our hurts and learn to empathize well, learn to hear well, and just be in each other's stories rather than holding on to ours so tightly, mm-hmm. it would allow for so many more voices to be heard.
Yes.
But it's mm-hmm. that struggle of this is my pain, this is my hurt, and mm-hmm. I'm afraid to let it go, right? Mm-hmm. That throws shame everywhere, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, George.
Yeah. Wow. Heavy.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to add a different perspective, since we are different perspectives discussing what matters, there are also a significant number of Asian Americans that deny their Asian Americanness.
Yeah.
And I have relatives that love being colonized. Particularly those from Hong Kong, they love the British rule more than their Chinese-ness that is in their genetics. Mm-hmm. And they have that Anglophile-ness. And perhaps there are Asians that love America and just want to be blend in. Mm-hmm. But I think this time with the anti-Asian hate crimes, it's got to be a wake-up call that if you look Asian, you are a potential target for yeah. violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as much as you want to love the benefits of American society, mm-hmm. you are no longer safe.
Yeah.
So wake up, people, and get some understanding about what it means to be what it means to look like Asian American, mm-hmm. and how America is really looking at you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're kind of speaking to the model minority myth, and it's like, yeah, even if you believe in that and you see yourself as a model minority and somehow protected by that status, this should really wake you up to it. No, it's a myth. It's a myth. Yeah, absolutely.
DJ, just... as you were saying that, I just remember the thing my parents drilled into me day in and day out growing up. And it was, and this was because I was like really involved in school and like getting into leadership and things like that. And they always said, George, just remember that no matter how American you become, you'll always be Hmong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard that too. Although mine wasn't Hmong, mine was Chinese.
Same. Yep, we all heard it. Don't forget, you're a person of color.
Right, right.
Yeah. How did that make you feel, George? I mean, do you remember how that felt to hear that and be told that by your parents?
Yeah, I think initially I was frustrated by it. Mm-hmm. Right, we go through this racial identity formation where I think at a very young age, we all kind of go into this conformity phase mm-hmm. of just like, I want to be like the people around me. Right? I want to be accepted and I will do whatever it takes to be accepted and live by the status quo. Mm-hmm. And so to hear my parents say that, I was like, are you resenting my success? Are you not wanting me to do well? Are you, mm-hmm. you know, wanting me to stay in this place of just being Hmong? And it wasn't until much later in life where I finally realized, oh my goodness, I came to this waking up of I am still just Hmong to these people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in the white spaces, I am just the token Asian. And mm-hmm. you know, going to seminary, I'm just this Asian guy sitting in the room, and they're assuming I'm probably Korean or Chinese. They don't even know that I'm Hmong. And then when I say I am Hmong, they're like, what's a Hmong?
Yeah.
And so it grew in me to actually help me recognize, man, there's so much about myself that I used to reject or I used to not like so much. But when my parents reminded me, like, hey, you're still Hmong, there's mm-hmm. a space in me where I'm like, man, there's a pride that grows, mm-hmm. that blossoms in that space where I'm just like, there's so much about my Hmongness that I love, that I mm-hmm. am so glad I still have and I haven't discarded from my identity. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. We're all like deeply processing. Yes. I think something that's coming up for me, that kind of processing both DJ and George, what you're talking about, because our identity formation and how colonized our minds and lives have been, for some people, it's a whole thing to even use a hashtag and join this Stop Asian Hate, you know, or Justice for Vicha. Because a lot of individuals and communities haven't yet identified as Asian American or even Asian. They're just, you know, whatever ethnicity they might be. And depending on their immigration journey, this is a whole, like, am I being invited to a new community here? If I use this hashtag, does this change how I identify in public or on social media? How will people view me? What does it mean, right? To join in with solidarity. In this kind of movement. Yeah. It's complicated. And I think we often feel shame about how complicated it is within us. And it's hard to talk about that, that we don't have all the answers and we don't have clarity or confidence about where we stand and how we feel. Yeah. This feels like a group therapy session. If you're watching out there. Free group therapy. Yeah.
Hopefully you're Silence doing your own okay. processing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of therapeutic, but it's not therapy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I know some therapists like to give that disclaimer.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
It's helpful to find safe spaces.
Yeah.
And that's something we're our culture is beginning to learn, this concept of safe spaces, mm-hmm. For diversity's sake, but even for also for us as Asian Americans to have the space for us to process our stories and our pains mm-hmm. and our shames. Mm-hmm. And then now this dark cloud of hatred and hate crimes looming over us. It's very visceral.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm participating in the few ways that I have access to, which is the Clubhouse conversations through the means of social media, since we can't meet in person. So in that sense, we can do something and stay connected and participate. So kind of the first decision is, will you participate or will you not? But there's some urgency, but we don't want to push people into it. We want wholehearted participation for those that recognize this is a need. And we need as many of you who are Asian and Asian Americans and even non-Asians mm-hmm. to participate. Because this mm-hmm. hate crime is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking through, man, why haven't I brought this up in my circles? Mm-hmm. And if I did, who would join me? Mm-hmm. Right. And the scary thought and probably the more rational thought is, I don't think anybody really would care. Right. It's not true, but it's the fear that we have, and so it's what we kind of hide away in, is I'll be silent because I don't know if anybody really is going to empathize or if they're going to want to step up and fight on my behalf, fight on my parents' behalf. But I see the ways in which communities have rallied for other civil rights and other social justice issues. And I wonder if Asians would be able to draw that same kind of empathy and draw that same kind of crowd or support, right? Mm-hmm. So those of you who are listening, one, ask your Asian friends how they're doing. because most of them are probably hurting and don't know how to share this, don't know how to speak out on this. So just ask. Don't wait for them to say something. But those of you who are Asian American and are listening and trying to answer these same questions that I'm asking, let's start being more vocal. Let's start sharing more so that we can actually help our communities come out of this hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and for people who, if you are not so active on social media and you don't really, you know, you're kind of in your pandemic bubble, if you didn't know about these events, not to feel ashamed that you didn't know. Because I didn't know right away either. And I struggled through, like, why didn't I know? Well, it's because I've been avoiding the news. And it's okay to just listen and, you know, be in a space where you're asking questions and learning if you don't feel that you're ready to speak up yet. Although we encourage it.
Thank you.
It's very empowering and healing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Leah, do you have a closing word as we close out this episode?
Not really. Hannah and George killed it. I think to be awake and to engage in the process of everyone's liberation and in the safety of our neighbors, it is a process. To recognize that we're all in different parts of that journey. And may your curiosity and may the dream of a near curiosity guide you to making a dream of a safer world for everybody like a reality. May that guide you and lead you to making that into a reality, a safer and a holistic place for Asians in this country and for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Leah. And that's an invitation to you, our viewers and listeners, that I hope as you've listened in our conversation, and it's been a model for how to create a safe space, and we want to be a safe space for you. Not to shout into social media, but if you want to confide in us, you can send us a message anonymously at erasingshame.com. We would love your feedback and participate in our community, because this very much is a community and a conversation, and we can give safety to one another as you are coming to terms with how you kind of tap into that survival instinct of how you protect yourself. And that's what's upon us in this season, and there's much work to do, and we would like to be on the journey and a resource for you. And stay connected with us on YouTube or Facebook. You can subscribe there. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, on Android, Google, Spotify, and everywhere else. The links are there at erasingshame.com. Share with a friend, family, and peers so that you can open up these conversations that are hard to talk about, but they are imminent and upon us. Thank you for being with us on this episode. Grateful for your participating just through listening. And we would love to hear more from you as we continue season 5 with different perspectives, discussing what matters. Have a great, courageous next step.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Erasing Shame podcast. Check out our website at erasingshame.com. We would love to hear your comments and questions. Please subscribe on any podcast app like Apple, Google, Spotify, or on Facebook and YouTube. And please add a rating, a review, and a share so more people can experience the freedom and healing that comes from erasing shame.